Chapter 12. Evil Has a Name.
Monica Tchaikovsky out of Sacramento DA's office sends an email out, and she says, "Hey, just so you know, I found a guy with California connections. In fact, he's got some Sacramento area connections. He's a former Auburn police officer." And she sent over information about a Joseph D'Angelo.
"We had this name, but I think there had been so many good suspects over the years, or people that you were convinced must be the guy, that I almost just felt programmed not to be too excited or not to really think this was it."
I'm like, "Well, that's interesting. You know, he's at least in the Sacramento area, but he's a full-time Auburn police officer. How is a full-time law enforcement officer committing all these attacks all over Northern California?" But he did have some interesting aspects to him. One of the pieces of information that Monica had found was an old newspaper article about his engagement to a Bonnie that had occurred in 1970. This was significant because in the third attack in Davis, California, while the East Area Rapist is raping that female, he is sobbing and he's saying, "I hate you, Bonnie, I hate you, Bonnie," over and over again. We always thought that our offender would have a significant female in his life named Bonnie. Could be a mother, could be a wife, an ex-wife, a girlfriend. We didn't know what the relationship would be. Now, did he marry Bonnie? I'm starting to go into my mode of, is Bonnie out there where I can go talk to her, or is she still married to him? But I wasn't able to find anywhere where there is a marriage license showing that those two were married. In fact, their address history during that time frame never showed that they were living together. So maybe this was an engagement that went sideways. Additionally, this D'Angelo had been fired from Auburn Police Department. He had been arrested in Citrus Heights for shoplifting a dog repellent and a hammer. Those are two odd things for a law enforcement officer to be shoplifting. The newspaper article had listed the name of the police chief that fired him back in August of 1979. And to put that date in perspective, August of 1979 is after every single Northern California attack. So at this point, when D'Angelo is being fired, the East Area Rapist had completed everything up in Northern California that we know about. I call up the current Auburn PD investigator, and I basically was just asking, "Do you have any personnel records from this Joseph D'Angelo? I need to verify his employment history with Auburn PD." And after about an hour, that investigator called me back and said, "We don't show any records that Joe D'Angelo is ever an employee of Auburn Police Department." And I was like, "Well, the newspaper article says it was Auburn police chief. Let me send you that article." When he called me back, he said, "Oh, I recognize that police chief's name right away, Nick Willick." He goes, "He was the youngest police chief in California history at the time. I know him. You need to talk to him," is what that investigator told me. So he gave me Nick's cell phone number. I immediately call Nick.
"My name's Nick Willick. I'm a retired police chief for the city of Auburn. I was police chief at the time that Joseph D'Angelo was arrested for shoplifting at a Pack and Save store in Citrus Heights."
And Nick says, "Oh, I remember Joe well. I was his sergeant when he first got up here at Auburn PD." And ultimately, Nick had promoted up to being Joe's chief. He told me, you know, that he remembers Joe, didn't think Joe was a very good police officer. He had some issues with his tactics, said Joe was living up in Auburn at the time, was athletic, blonde, light-eyed, kind of matching what we thought the East Area Rapist would look like. Told me there were some odd things about Joe. One of the things that he mentioned is that when he went to Joe's house, he noticed that Joe and Joe's wife were sleeping in separate rooms. So maybe that gave him some additional freedoms. He then proceeded to tell me that during the termination process of D'Angelo, that D'Angelo had told the administrative officer involved that he wanted to kill Nick. That's exactly how I would expect these dare rapists to respond. I never told Nick during this phone conversation that I was investigating the East Area Rapist series. Nick then told me the single most important thing that pushed me over from thinking D'Angelo as being an interesting guy to D'Angelo as somebody we need to get DNA from.
I woke up one morning and my daughter, then was, I believe, 4 years old, just turned 4 years old, was laying on the floor asleep. I asked her what she was doing there, and she said, I woke up last night and there was a flashlight being shown through my bedroom window, and I got scared. And I went outside, and I did find some footprints around the house.
And he told me, I'm convinced that was D'Angelo. I decided, we need to get this guy's DNA. Nick Willick asked me, Paul, what exactly are you investigating? And I said, I'm investigating an old series of sexual assaults that started out in Sacramento and then proceeded to go all over Northern California back in the 70s. And he said, is this the East Area Rapist case? I was like, yes, sir, it is. It turns out he had a ton of guns registered to his name. So many so that the DOJ system reported that they couldn't list all the weapons and that I needed to contact their office in Sacramento to get a full list. Additionally, his list of registered firearms included purchasing a weapon out of Los Angeles County in 1986. 1986 is when we had our very last known attack. So he is, once again, being placed in the general vicinity of a known attack in our series. So in March of 2017, I am a year away from turning 50. 50 is a magic number in our retirement system. The clock is ticking. So now I go full bore into investigating this case in order to be able to retire at the end of March 2018, realizing that D'Angelo rose to the level of getting a DNA sample. I'm now moving into my investigative mode. Where is Bonnie? I find Bonnie. I call Bonnie. She doesn't answer the phone, but I leave a message. This is March 23rd, 2018. I'm now getting into my last week on the job.
It's now March 26, 2018. We're back to where our story began.
Right now, I'm standing in front of D'Angelo's driveway. On March 26, I parked right across the street where I had clear view of his house. There was a car parked right in the driveway, right where we're standing here. This neighborhood, which is a solid middle-class neighborhood, is exactly what I was envisioning he would live. This is almost identical to most of the neighborhoods where he attacked. At the time that I came here, he was just an interesting guy, but I've had so many suspects where I thought, oh, I think I've got the guy, that you become jaded. I was not entirely confident he's the guy. He had just risen up to the level of what I call a prime suspect. We needed to get his DNA. You know, in hindsight, when I take a look at what could have happened when I approached the house that day, you look at the front door and how it's protected by that, almost like a tunnel. And I've kind of referred to that before as a tunnel of death. If he had seen me approaching, he could have armed himself. I'm recognizable. I'm associated with the case. Or he could have cooperated, give me some background information, agreed to give DNA, and I leave, happy-go. I'm probably thinking he's not the guy. He could have gotten on his motorcycle and been bombing down I-5, headed to Mexico or up to Canada. Or he could have decided it's time to take his own life, or get ready for the cops to come and barricade himself in, or have hostages. Things could have gone really bad. And that's where, in hindsight, it was a very good decision to drive away.
The next day, Paul turns in his badge and gun and officially retires from law enforcement. Within hours, a surveillance team attaches itself to Joseph James D'Angelo. They park at a distance from his house in the small, quiet Citrus Heights neighborhood, and they try to blend in, watching as their primary suspect comes and goes. And when he goes, they follow him, hoping he'll discard something, at which point they'll quietly and inconspicuously grab it so they can swab it for DNA. Meanwhile, Paul Holes is getting constant updates. He's not retired from the case in the least. In fact, he's at the center of it.
My wife and I had decided to move to Colorado Springs, and that week we had planned to shop for a home. So I'm out in Colorado Springs, and every day, every night, I am being called by Steve Kramer. I am being called by Ken Clark, and Ken is funny. He is excitable, and he is saying, I don't want to get too excited, but this D'Angelo guy is looking really, really good, and I'm starting to talk to him, and I bring up, hey, did you know that he used to have a bond? He was like, no shit. And he's talking about, hey, this guy, he's 72 years old, but he moves around like a 50-year-old guy. Being told about how D'Angelo is getting on a motorcycle and bombing down the freeway at over 100 miles an hour. If he's driving his car, he's not paying attention to the rules of the road. He rolls through all the stop signs. You would think somebody who's the East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, the original Night Stalker, would be doing everything within the law to prevent from being contacted. But how did he not slip up over all these years?
It's possible that at this point in his life, the suspect feels unstoppable because he's gotten away with his crimes for so long. He's clearly a risk taker. Maybe he loves the rush. But despite this brazen behavior, he might still be trying to avoid being caught.
One night, Ken calls me and said, hey, our boy just did a gypsy run. He said the guy tried to slip surveillance. And he proceeded to tell me how D'Angelo got into his car and got on the freeway and was doing counter-surveillance maneuvers to try to determine whether or not he was being followed. And I was like, did you guys get made? And he goes, I don't think so. It's one of those things we don't know. Did he do that routinely because he was paranoid? Or did he actually see something? So they had to back away at a point in time because they did not want him to figure out he was under surveillance. That's when the decision was made, we've got to do whatever we can to get this surreptitious sample. He's not a guy that's going to Starbucks and leaving a cup with DNA behind. He was routinely going to auto parts stores or the Hobby Lobby, and at a point when he parked his car and went into this Hobby Lobby store, an undercover agent went up and swabbed his car door handle, and that was submitted to the lab. Meanwhile, I'm out in Colorado Springs. I'm looking for houses and ultimately put an offer on a house, and my wife and I go to celebrate that, and we go and eat at P.F. Chang's in Colorado Springs. And as I'm sitting there, had finished eating dinner, my cell phone lights up.
I immediately called Paul Holes. Paul was actually with his wife at P.F. Chang's.
That's Kirk Campbell from SAC DA's office. Okay, I'm getting an update, hold on, and I excuse myself. People are coming in and out, you know, from the restaurant. And Kirk, first thing he says is, you absolutely cannot tell anybody what I'm about to tell you. And I immediately knew, okay, there's something up here. And Kirk tells me, we got the DNA results back, and I don't entirely know what they've got, but the lab is really excited about what they're seeing. And I was like, well, what did they tell you? He says, there's like a partial profile, but it's like 20 markers that match. And I knew, because of my DNA experience, it's the guy. And I told Kirk that. That's him. And there's no question. So we hang up. I go back inside. And at this point, the fortune cookies had been delivered. My wife had opened up her fortune cookie, and I don't remember the exact phrase, but it had something to do with, you will find the perfect home. And so she was super excited with the fact that we had just put an offer on a house. And I sit down. She claims that my face was white, and I don't believe that for a second. All I knew was, is I'm not telling her inside this restaurant, because I know what her reaction is going to be, and I can't alert the restaurant, everybody here, what the heck is going on. So I'm just sitting there as the waiter comes and he's taking the dishes away, and she's looking at me and she's going, what did Kirk want? And I didn't respond. And she was like, do they have DNA results? And I just did a single nod. And she said, no. I remember her kind of sitting a little bit straighter up because she's a former DNA analyst. And I just gave another single nod and she says, no way. And I just gave another single nod. And all of a sudden she's squealing and it's like, we got to get out of here before she just explodes in this spasm of emotions. And so we stand up and she's literally pushing me out the restaurant to our car. I know at this point, I had invested 24 years in this case. The last 10 years was 24/7 trying to solve this thing. After all that time, we had done it. But we still had stuff to do. SAC-DA's office wants a second sample, one that will generate a full profile. I finish my business out in Colorado Springs, fly back, and first thing that Monday morning, we are putting together the arrest warrant. Sacramento Sheriff's Office put in a plan in order to get some of D'Angelo's trash when he pushed it out onto the street, and the crime lab located a piece of tissue that contained DNA material. We had a 100% match across all the markers to the Golden State Killer. So, April 24th, 2018, that's when the arrest warrant was signed. We are standing right in front of D'Angelo's house. He was probably 20 feet away from where we're standing. This is a guy that we know is willing to kill. He's killed multiple people. He's even shot at an officer in his criminal history. We know he's got guns. We don't want him going back into the house where he has family members that he could keep hostage. This is not something where you just walk up to the front door, knock, and have him answer. He could be walking to the front door with a gun in hand. We've got to arrest him while he's out in front of his house. I was able to listen to it from the war room where myself, the FBI agents, and the Ventura detectives were sitting. All we could hear was the voice of the team leader, and he just said, it's a go. And at that point, the entire war room goes silent. When you're in law enforcement, you know bad things can occur during this type of process. We're sitting there on pins and needles, waiting to get an update. And then at a certain point, we hear, suspect in custody. The entire room just erupted. Guys jumping out of their chairs. They're high-fiving each other. There's a lot of woo-hoos. And I'm kind of sitting there in my mind. I'm now in my action mode. Okay, East Area Rapist Golden State Killer is in custody. He's coming in for an interview. And this is going to be a long night.
So I'm sitting in my room at my desk. I read this email. There's something going on with the case. Have you heard anything?
I got this phone call. It's this detective, a retired detective from Sacramento Sheriff's Department. And he said, you don't know me, but I grew up down the street from your family. I just want to be the first one to tell you we have the East Area Rapist in custody. And I couldn't believe it. I was so happy. It was just beyond me. But then he said, you can't tell a soul. This won't even be made public until tomorrow. They're going to have a news conference at noon tomorrow. You can't tell anyone. Well, we got off the phone, and I immediately called Debbie Domingo.
And I said, whoa, Margaret, slow down. Who is this source? And she says, I know this is right. They got him. I'm so happy. She says, I'm so happy. I said, I'm happy for you, but I said, that doesn't sound like an official source to me. And she says, who should I call? And I'm like, Margaret. I said, what do you mean, who should you call? I'm not calling anybody until I know this is real. And she says, well, I'm calling everybody. I said, okay, fine, Margaret.
I tried Jane. She was out of the country at the time.
I found out he was caught when I received a text on my phone from retired Detective Larry Crompton.
Richard Shelby emailed me and said, there's a rumor. Did you hear that they arrested the East Area Rapist? I thought, no, I hadn't heard that. So I called Larry Poole and I said, Larry, did you hear that they have arrested the East Area Rapist, Riddle Night Stalker? And he said, no, I hadn't.
I actually got a phone call from Paul and Steve.
I was sitting at my desk, and somebody just walked by and said, hey, that's pretty cool. They caught the original Night Stalker. I was like, what do you mean?
He said, Carol, we've just identified who the East Area Rapist is. I said, you're kidding. I just couldn't believe it. I talked to Jane, and I felt bad because Jane started crying and crying. And then I'm crying, and I said, Jane, I got more phone calls to make. I can't listen to you cry.
And I was just so happy and excited. And, oh, my gosh, I was just trying to process it all. That was it. I mean, it was just such a good feeling.
I probably used a few words I shouldn't have said.
My husband and I, at that time, were in a hotel room, and we screamed and we cried, and oh my goodness, we woke up all the guests in the hotel.
And everything inside me was I
was overjoyed. I couldn't stop smiling. I couldn't go to sleep that night.
It was a very long journey and a very quick ending.
D'Angelo is put into the interview room. Unfortunately, I did not get the opportunity to be able to sit across a table and ask D'Angelo questions, but I watched.
My name is Steve Rhodes. Mr. D'Angelo chose not to speak. I straight up told him, I said, you're here because of your DNA being inside of Charlene Smith. I just straight out accused him, and then you killed her, beat her to death with a log. His response was, I didn't kill anybody. And then he started talking out loud to himself. And I told him, you're going to jail. And I walked out.
I saw a defeated man. I saw somebody who never thought this day would come. The magnitude of finding D'Angelo did not set in that night. About 3 a.m. in the morning, decided I need to go home and get some sleep as we were going to show up at D'Angelo's house first thing in the morning to get a walkthrough before the evidence processing work was to occur. So I go home, I get some sleep, I come back, and I go out to D'Angelo's house. We get led through. It was fascinating finally seeing how this man lived, this guy I had been looking for so long. The most notable thing that I saw, he had a computer set up. And that monitor was covered by a towel. That struck me immediately because the East Area Rapist, when he would take the female victim and pull her out into the family room, before he started the sexual assault, he would turn on the TV, keep the sound off, and then put a towel over it in order to get that low light illumination so he could see her. So he could see her body, so he could see the fear in her face. And here he was, as a 72-year-old man, with a towel over his computer monitor. My immediate thought was, he's replicating the crime scene from way back in the day. He's continuing to fantasize about what he did to these victims back in the 1970s. After that walkthrough, I had to get out to the press conference that will announce to the world that the Golden State Killer was finally caught. So I drive from D'Angelo's house to get out to the Sacramento DA's office crime lab where the press conference is going to be held. And I get there, I'm in a meeting where there's the planning of how the politicians are going to be presenting, what politician is going to be speaking when, and then we go out and now Anne Marie Schubert makes the announcement that Joseph James D'Angelo has been arrested for being the Golden State Killer.
The man known as the East Area Rapist and Golden State Killer terrorized Sacramento and California neighborhoods in the 1970s and 80s. Investigators now have a suspect.
We turn now to Sacramento, California, where authorities today announced the arrest of a suspect in the decades-old Golden State Killer case. Here's Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert.
We found the needle in the haystack, and it was right here in Sacramento.
The press conference is over and everybody's dispersing. I agreed to meet up with the small team that did the investigative genealogy work at a local restaurant for lunch in a mini celebration that, hey, we got here. I'm driving to that restaurant. My cell phone lights up, and I look down, and I see the name of one of the victims who I'd spoken to about 10 years prior, and she did not want to meet with me back then. She was so scared. She was a victim who was 13 years old when this guy came in and raped her while her father was sleeping in the bedroom next door. And I say hi. And on the other end, I hear this meek voice. And she's saying and asking, "Is it him? Is it really him?" And I responded, "Yes, it's him, and he will never get out to hurt anybody else again." And all I hear on the other end is just an explosion of sobbing. And she is sobbing for like 20 seconds. And then she gathers herself saying, I'm sorry, I'm not upset, I'm just so happy." She had lived in fear, thinking that he would come back. And now knowing that he can't was liberating. When I hung up, it was at that moment that I realized that I had made a difference. So when I arrived for the lunch with the genealogy team, I had a little bit more pep in my step because finally it sunk in that what we had done meant so much to so many people.